Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Now we are together, sitting outside in the sunshine, but soon we'll be apart, and soon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me today, my good friend, John Mills. John, it is so good to have you back on the show.
It is good to have me back on the show, Sean. And I'm happy to be back on the show and see your beautiful face looking back at me, having one of our monumental conversations here on Missing Frames.
And I love how humble you are. I love that you are. That's my favorite thing about you. It's been a while since we last spoke. It's been 9 years since our last conversation.
It is flown by. I had no idea.
Yeah, it feels like it went by just in the blink of an eye. And you haven't changed much at all, really, come to think of it.
No.
In fact, I kind of hate you for not changing. You should have changed at least a little bit in that amount of time.
The only thing that has changed is my heart, Sean. My heart. But it still beats strongly for you.
That's extremely romantic, and I'm glad we got that admission. We got that. We're recording this. My people have confirmed that we recorded that, so that is officially going to be cemented in the interweb space forever. But we're back, and again, I'm so excited about this episode because this is actually a continuation of something we started, actually, I think about half a year ago, so not quite 9 years, but... still very exciting, and we are going to be watching the sequel to Before Sunrise, Before Sunset. And Before Sunset, if you listened to the Before Sunrise episode, you will know this. And actually, if you haven't, I would highly encourage you to go back and listen to that. Before Sunset is my favorite of Richard Linklater's Before trilogy. I don't want to say too much about it, obviously, because John, you have not seen it. But I will say, of the three, if I had to pick one, this is my pick.
So this would be the Empire Strikes Back of the Before trilogy.
That's exactly it. I would say that.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah. So I would highly encourage you, if you haven't already, to go back and listen to the Before Sunrise episode and then wait 9 years and listen to this episode. And if you don't want to wait that long, you don't have to. I won't make you. But in the meantime, while you're checking out that episode, make sure to just go to thenerdparty.com and check out all the other awesome, great shows. John, you have a couple great shows. So you want to talk about those? Plug yourself a little bit. You
sure,
have my permission.
Sure. Here on the
to die.
Here on the Nerd Party, you can find me over on Aggressive Negotiations, which is a Star Wars podcast that plumbs the sort of thematic depths of the Star Wars galaxy. I co-host that with Matthew Rushing. And then there's Great Shot Kid, which is a Star Wars program of a different sort, where it actually looks at the technical and inspirational aspects for the Star Wars creators that we know and love, comparing their works, looking at things that influenced how things came together, even did an episode on the history of Star Wars video games. So those are both a pip.
They're awesome. I highly recommend everyone check them out, and just go to facebook.com/thenerdparty, like us on Facebook, share all our stuff, make us famous, and you know what? We'll give you a nice peck on the cheek.
Yes.
That's what we do here at the Nerd Party.
We will kiss a piece of paper, and we will mail it to you.
Yeah, exactly. Just send us your message with 5 UPCs, barcodes cut up from your favorite cereal box. Doesn't matter which. Just send them
cereal.
Over. In fact, just send the cereal boxes, because I love cereal. Yes. And we are at Join Nerd Party on Twitter. So I'd encourage you to follow us on there. Follow us everywhere. If we haven't already convinced you not to, I'm shocked. But yeah, please do. We love you. So anyway, back to the point. So Before Sunset, John, I have to say, I love listening to me talk. I do love listening to you talk. And I really, really enjoy our Before Sunrise episode. It's one of my favorites in the Missing Frames, the brief history that we have so far. It's one of my favorites. And I was I was very nervous about showing you Before Sunrise because, as I discussed in that episode, these are my favorite movies, and they are very near and dear to me. So I was really, really happy that it connected with you, Before Sunrise. And I wonder, I mean, it's been 6 months since we watched it. I mean, what continues to stick in your mind about it? And has it kind of come up? Have you watched any other Linklater movies and kind of like, has it made you appreciate him more? Or like, so just kind of catch me up a bit on where your life has been since that episode.
Well, I still, just even thinking about Before Sunset puts a smile on my face and makes me feel warm inside.
Before Sunset? Wow. And you haven't even seen it
yet.
Oh,
I mean Before Sunrise. I apologize. There's so much before going on. I mean Before
Sunrise.
There's
so sunrise.
Many sunrises,
I'm sorry. Sunsets, midnights. They're going to have to switch over into After for the next one.
Yes. No, but Before Sunrise is something that has stuck with me. Like, I think back on it. It really was so great that it finally tipped everything over, and I finally cracked open the Blu-ray of Boyhood, which you had given me as a gift 16,
right.
17 years ago or something.
I don't know if we talked about this in the last, in the Before Sunrise episode, but I got John... For I think it was Christmas 2014?
14
or 15. Okay, so I got him the Blu-ray 15. Of Boyhood.
It would have been 15. Yes.
Because I think I gave it to you right before we saw The Force Awakens.
Yeah, you got it for me, and actually it still had the gift receipt on it. So it was December 2015.
I think you told me then, you said, great, I can't wait to not watch
this. I'm a man of my word, Sean. I'm a man of my word.
you were, and it took you a while to get around to it. So just to be clear, it took him about a year and a half to actually watch this wonderful, gracious, and very thoughtful gift I'd gotten you. But you did it. So did you enjoy Boyhood?
I loved Boyhood. I thought it was great. I think that what happened is that as I think back on it, and I sent you a couple of messages about it, is that my previous exposure to Linklater was a movie that I didn't like, which was Dazed and Confused. That was, I didn't care for it at all. And I remember it specifically had to do with the ending and the way that it went. And I think that created a sour taste. And then Before Sunrise, I think, reset my brain. Or maybe enough time has passed. Maybe for all I know, I'm going to go back and watch Dazed and Confused and love it now. But Before Sunrise was a perspective shifter where it, I don't know. I guess it just set me, it's such a wonderful film that I guess it put me on his wavelength finally. Maybe I was in a place where Dazed and Confused wasn't the wavelength that I was ready for or something like that. But Before Sunrise, I just think, I mean, it really is. I run the risk of just like repeating all of the praise that I had for it when I watched it that first time. But, you know, to speak to you, you know, being nervous about showing it to me, it's not because like my opinion was going to change your opinion of the film or anything like that. But when...
Right.
When a film means something to you, you know, you really, it becomes important for somebody else to be able to see why it's important to you.
Yeah, Before Sunrise is a very special film in that it communicates ideas and feelings that are very sensitive and very personal. Like, it is a very personal movie. If you share that with somebody, it's not like you're sitting down and watching Star Wars, although Star Wars is just as personal to me if showing somebody that. But Star Wars is different. Star Wars is not a, like, here are feelings and thoughts that I consider very important.
Yeah.
As far as, like, you know, I'm bearing my soul and my heart to you and kind of, you know, talking to someone on point. So that was, I think that was the real nervousness about it, is like, this film is very personal in that there's a lot of stuff in this movie that I feel reflects things that mean a lot to me.
No, I think it's good that you bring up the Star Wars example, because Star Wars is meaningful.
Because we love talking about Star Wars, too.
Yeah, that's true.
So why not? why not bring it back to Star Wars?
No, but something like Star Wars is, you know, it's a monumental film. It's an important film. It's all of those things. But it's also an archetypal film. It's broad strokes film, you know, teaching moral lessons and stuff like that. But to your point, Before Sunrise is a film about real human emotions that everyday people feel, that you and I have experienced in different relationships and in all of these things. And so that, I think, is the magic. And I picked that up in Boyhood, too. I think that is the magic of Linklater. And what that I finally get is that he's specifically speaking on an emotional wavelength that is truly, in a sense, universal. It's something where you can say, I recognize this from my own life, as opposed to,
I think,
The Godfather. Oh, The Godfather is a fantastic film. I've never been in the mafia, and I wasn't alive in the 1940s. So it's not that I can relate to it too well.
You can relate, though, to calling hits on people, because I've had to dodge a few fishy situations. No, but I mean, it's completely true. I honestly really genuinely believe this. I think Linklater, arguably more than any other filmmaker, recognizes the beauty and the importance of, quote unquote, the moment, just a moment in someone's life that you recognize as like, this is significant, this means something. And on the outside, it might not look like anything profound, but because of what it means to you, what it means to whoever else is there, it is profound. And it mean that that no matter how ordinary it is, that means something. And
you know
talking about Dazed and Confused, I know we talked a bit about it in the Before Sunrise episode. I mean, I still don't love Dazed and Confused. I think going back to it, I respect it more because I know I enjoy Linklater's films and I like seeing where he came from as a filmmaker. But I do feel like Before Sunrise was, that to me feels like the moment where it was like, boom, he got it. And I really think it was just beyond just him as a filmmaker, because he is a great filmmaker. I think it was just the combination of him working with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, and just their brains working together. They kind of threw themselves completely into it, even though they're not credited as co-writers on the first one. They are on Sunset, so they did have a lot of creative influence on the first one as far as what the conversations were, how the story and the characters, they did have influence, and this time they're actually credited as such. But I think that's part of the reason. I think it just worked, and I think Linklater kind of found a way to collaborate with people that just elevated him as a director and a writer.
You know what else, by a different filmmaker, something else that, and I'll make the point as briefly as I can. I think that also seeing Untitled, the director's cut of Almost Famous, not done by Linklater, but seeing that also within a close time span of Before Sunrise and then Boyhood, I think what I've realized, what is really fascinating about Linklater and directors like him is that what they capture is what always took me to live theater and why I've always loved live theater. And I think that it is too easy to dismiss the accomplishment of getting that on film, which is a very different medium, but getting something that intimate, because what used to always set live theater apart from film was film is bombastic, film is manipulative, film is directed and focused, whereas live theater, you can see something in the staging or the lighting that isn't even what the director intends for you to see initially, but every aspect of that has its own life. And I think that a lot of that came across in Before Sunrise, where it was them and they were in frame and they were moving and they were talking and they were having interactions, but then you would notice a little something in the background. It's like, that's the type of thing that I'd remember. If I were going through this, I'd remember, oh yeah, and that doorway that was behind her. That pool hall we stopped in was, oh man, that place smelled so bad. You know, that sort of thing is, I think, what Linklater is able to capture in Before Sunrise.
Before Sunrise, one of the beautiful things about it is, and setting plays a big part in all three movies in different ways. Before Sunrise is very much there are characters all around them. The guy who reads them the poem, the gypsy lady who reads their fortunes, the people at the beginning, the two Germans they meet who are doing a play, and they never end up seeing the play. There are a lot of character. It's almost like a fairy tale in a way. It's almost a fable, like this magical moment. We met all these magical different people. We all connected. It's a very magical movie, and it captures that moment where you are passionate and in love with life, and you've met someone you've connected with, and you feel like all these things and everything around you is beautiful, and you want to experience it and recognize the beauty of it. And one of the great things about Before Sunset is somebody who watches Before Sunrise and says, it's a little too good to be true, could then go and watch Before Sunset and be like, huh, that's really interesting. Because Before Sunset is very much a kind of morning after movie. Like it's like the next day. Obviously it takes place 9 years later, but it is very much a Before Sunrise is seen as a moment, and Before Sunset is kind of the reality. It brings reality into it in a way that is very fascinating. And time plays a big part in the movie. As I said, it is 80 minutes of real time, which is awesome. That's part of why I think it's my favorite. It's just that they do that and they pull it off. Or you will be the judge whether or not you agree with that.
I will. I will arbitrate that one.
I almost feel like I have to set up Before Sunset in a way that kind of tempers expectations, but really I don't want to. It feels like such a genuine extension of the first film, while also kind of acknowledging that time has passed in a really, really profound way that I honestly don't think I've seen happen in movies other than Linklater's, because Linklater he's kind of made a career out of focusing on time and making time a strong strong character in his films and a strong element in his films.
Well, let me ask that question then, because since I have seen Boyhood, I've seen them sort of out of order in terms of their releases.
But not really, because he was shooting Boyhood before he shot Before Sunset.
I said his release is not. Boyhood was still. But okay. But the
isn't that kind of cool though that he was shooting Boyhood before Sunset.
That
it's kind of crazy.
That is kind of nuts. That is, I'm going to pay probably too much attention to Ethan Hawke's facial hair at first, then, knowing that. But is seeing Boyhood any sort of spoiler or better prep for Before Sunset? Because I've seen Before Sunrise, and I know how that works. And I've seen Boyhood, and I know how that works. And you're talking about the use of time and everything. Boyhood, like, now I'm intrigued because I'm wondering if Boyhood is something of a prep for now I'm really even more excited to see Before Sunset, because as we're talking about it, does that sort of change the perception of how I'll see Before Sunset?
That I don't know. We'll have to talk about that after we watch it. I really don't know. I know it was fun to watch Boyhood and think to myself like, oh yeah, it's 2004 now. Ethan Hawke does resemble himself in Before Sunset, which was also being shot. And then around 2013, because it's funny, Before Midnight came out 2013, then Boyhood was 2014. So I think the difference between Boyhood and the Before trilogy, and the reason why I prefer the Before trilogy, is that the Before trilogy is so focused in on two specific characters. Mm-hmm. Boyhood is almost like a life seen through this kid's eyes, and he doesn't play necessarily an active role in his life, and he can't quite articulate how he's feeling about it. He's more of an observer, whereas the Before movies are two people actively aware of their situation and communicating with each other about it, which makes them more interesting to me, as much as I love Boyhood. But it'll be interesting to see how this works with you going back and watching Before Sunset after.
You realize now, though, because of what you've said about Boyhood, and I think you're absolutely right with that read of it, it actually makes me want to work it into a film festival with the prequels, because that sounds essentially like Anakin. He's the hero of his own story, but the world is going on around him.
Only you would find a way to compare the Star Wars prequels to Boyhood and Richard Linklater.
Yes.
You jerk.
Yes. I win. I win all.
Well, John, I have a question for you. So at the end of Before Sunrise, obviously we know this takes place 9 years later. At the end of Before Sunrise, Jesse and Celine agreed to meet 6 months later. What do you think happened? What are your predictions for what's happened between then and now? Do you think they did meet 6 months later? I want to hear your thoughts, because it's going to be great to discuss after as well and to capture this moment and see what you think.
Coming out of Before Sunrise, the impression I had was that, I mean, honestly, I'm trying to, like, I guess play a game in my brain, but like, if I had seen Before Sunrise and then they said, oh, and guess what? Before Sunset is coming out. That honestly, I'm so curious to see how it works, because I viewed Before Sunrise as that was the once in a lifetime event. That was the, you always tell people about that story and it was a cool story, but nothing ever happened afterward. Maybe you wondered, it's like, oh, I wonder what they're up to. But I can honestly say I have no expectation for what happened afterward, because I viewed it as simply self-contained and nothing was going to happen afterward. It was the end of the story.
And that's what a lot of people thought too. And it's funny, because when Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy and Richard Linklater started discussing the sequel and said, we want to make this, the immediate reaction from fans of the film and everyone around them was, what is wrong with you? Why? Why would you do this? First of all, the movie is perfect. It should not be messed with. Leave it alone. If you make a sequel, there's no way it's going to be better. You're gonna potentially ruin what made the first one so special and magical. And I think I told this story in the last one, but I have to tell it in this episode too. Julie Delpy's agent fired her because of this movie, because she was supposed to go do an audition for Rush Hour 3, and she decided to stay in a hotel and write this movie with Linklater and Hawke instead. And clearly she made the wrong career choice.
Well, you know, but, I mean, an agent's got to pay the bills too, Sean. And I think that, I mean, how could you pass up the opportunity to work with Brett Ratner on Rush Hour 3? I mean, come on.
I think it was the second one. Yeah, second one came out 2004.
Listen,
I don't know. They all kind of run together anyway.
I was gonna say much like.
I don't think anyone out there, no one out there, is listening to this episode and saying it was Rush Hour 2. How could you do this?
Rush Hour, Rush Hour 2, and Rush Hour 3 are Brett Ratner's Before trilogy. Discuss.
They're filmed 9 years apart. The relationship. It's interesting to see the relationship between Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker, how the romance and the way they communicate with each other. But no, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I think a lot of people felt the same exact way. Like when Before Sunset, there was a strong aversion to it, not because people didn't trust them, but I think there is a danger when you have a movie as special as Before Sunrise that is so self-contained and about this moment. It's like, you do kind of rob it a bit of its innocence if you start to revisit that a little bit. And I think that was the concern.
Some people would hate to hear this, but I would refer to that as the Highlander principle, where it's like, Highlander 2. No, guys, come on. We had a good run. Let's be happy with it. But I have to give a lot of credit. I would have fallen squarely in that camp. And there are times where that's still my initial reaction, but I really have to give a lot of credit to Mike Schindler, my co-host over on Great Shot Kid, because I would get into discussions like that with him. He and I have been podcasting together for many years. And a point that he always comes back to, because I would beat up on, oh, they remade Psycho and that's stupid. And, or they made a sequel to this and that's stupid. I can't believe they did that. And his attitude, which finally rubbed off on me, was, it doesn't change anything. If you loved the first one, like if Aliens had been a terrible, terrible movie, doesn't mean Alien is any less special or wonderful. It just means that the sequel wasn't, you know, or Alien 3.
It's
does
true.
Does anybody ever refer to Alien 3 as diminishing aliens? No.
I mean, that's a very interesting perspective. I think it's tough sometimes, because I think then you can flip that on its head and say, does Spider-Man 3 ruin the quality of Spider-Man 1 and 2? It almost takes away a little bit, but not really. I mean, I've forgotten that Spider-Man 3 exists, and I watch Spider-Man 2 and I'm completely happy.
Star
life
Trek
is much
5.
Better as a result.
Did Star Trek 5 take away from 4 at all?
No.
Did 6 take away from 5?
Right, exactly. You couldn't take anything. You couldn't take anything more away from 5.
If you subtract from 0, you still got 0.
But no, that's a good point. I think it's tougher because, again, and Ethan Hawke jokes that the Before trilogy is the lowest grossing trilogy of all time. I don't know if that's actually accurate, but it's still hysterical. But it is one of those things where it's like, I think it is like sequels. A lot of the times they're made for financial reasons more so than creative reasons. And very rarely do you find that not to be the case. The Before trilogy is one of the cases, ironically, where I think sequels become necessary, and you didn't. It's amazing because you didn't realize that's what you needed, but you do once you've seen them. And on that note, I don't want to say anything else. I want you to watch it. So where is your head at right now? Are you excited?
Extremely. I'm seriously like super excited to see it. I have wanted to return and revisit these characters because I know, and I will publicly thank you for a very generous gift from the Sean Eastridge Foundation has made it possible to watch these films, and they sit on my shelf, and I think they become of all of the films that I've received as gifts through the years from you or other people, this will be the quickest I've ever watched one that was given to me.
I was about to say, I appreciate that you are using this gift within a year. That means so much.
It is groundbreaking. You have no idea.
Well, let's go ahead and let's go watch this silly movie.
Now available to own on video cassette.
Welcome back, everybody. We just watched Before Sunset.
Yeah.
The question on the world's mind, the fate of the universe hangs in the balance.
Yes.
John, what did you think of Before Sunset?
I think that my reaction is best summed up by the end of the film when I pretty much fell forward and said, "What? No!" And realized what they had done to me, and they had stolen my heart yet again. What an amazing and perfect film.
You are an amazing and perfect human being.
All again, it took was agreeing on a film.
Unfortunately, we did record that, and that is
going on the business cards now.
That's good. Yeah. Well, that's great. And isn't the ending is so fascinating? And it's one of those endings that gets better and better the more you think about it. It was I had a very similar experience because I related in the first episode we did for Before Sunrise, I watched them both back to back on a plane. And Before Sunrise is a very, it's a very complete experience. You feel like you've run the gamut of emotions. Yep. You've experienced an entire story. And Before Sunset, my immediate reaction was, no. Directed by Richard Linklater. No. Keep going.
Yeah.
And then I realized how brilliant it was. And I remember my friend was with me at the time. We were both flying to Austria together. And I passed him. I finished Before Sunrise. He was in the row behind me. And I passed it back to him on the plane. And he didn't watch Before Sunset until we got to the hotel. So I actually watched Before Sunset twice within a 24-hour period. We had trouble sleeping because of jet lag. And I was like, let's just put Before Sunset on. Do you want to watch it? And I remember watching it again. I almost appreciated the ending more just seeing how he reacted to it. Cause he went, huh? Cause it just fades out. It fades out and you aren't expecting it. And I think the immediate reaction is almost something akin to disappointment. And then you realize why you're disappointed. And then you realize how brilliant it is.
I'll step off here and I'll say first and foremost, if anybody thinks we're in spoiler territory, not really. This isn't like blowing the ending of The Empire Strikes Back or something like that. There's an artistic choice at the end that we're talking about that specifically leaves the audience in a state of uncertainty. And I think it's brilliant. I wasn't so much disappointed. Disappointment isn't the right word, but at the same time, I realized what had happened, which is an amazing feat, especially with a sequel, is I had gotten so reinvested with these characters, no matter how or where it ended, I was going to be sad because I was no longer with them.
Yeah.
I wanted to stay with them. I was not happy that my time with these two wonderful, beautiful people was over again. And it was, I mean, the whole film, I very recently, and I said this when I talked about Dunkirk, I had this almost like dissociative reaction to the film the first time I saw it, where I was experiencing the emotions, but then there was this intellectual part of my brain saying, what am I experiencing right now? I don't understand what is happening to me. And the same thing happened here, where I just appreciated the artistry so damn much as to what had gone into this. It absolutely amazed me how it felt so different but the same. Like there's so much about this film that is so just perfect. I mean, it's
so much like it is an amazing feat, but it's so much like Jesse and Celine seeing each other again. You fall back into the rhythm of the film very quickly.
Yeah.
And it feels like you're being reunited with old friends, which is a stunning thing to achieve that you kind of, I can't imagine. Again, we talked about it a little bit in the pre-show where we talked about the anticipation or the lack thereof, or
right.
Basically the extreme fear of this movie and like people being like, why would you touch that? Please don't, you know, you stand to ruin everything. And then the kind of, not just a sigh of relief watching it, but like way above and beyond a sigh of relief.
Yes.
Where you're like, not only am I relieved and happy, I can't imagine Before Sunrise without this movie now. And the two complement each other so well. And like you said, they're similar, but there are strong differences. And it comes from the strength of, right from the get-go, it's the acknowledgement of the passage of time. That this is not going to be a repeat of, like, you know, they're still walking around a European city. They even make a joke about, like, oh, maybe we're only good for brief encounters walking around European cities in warm climate.
Yeah.
Even poking fun at themselves, just like kind of like, you know, how can you put the weight of an entire, like, such a huge weight, like love and who you want to spend the rest of your life with on this brief thing? But it's beautiful that right from the get-go, they kind of established, like, time has passed. And a good chunk of the movie is almost throwaway dialogue. And I say that with utmost respect, because there's not a single moment I can do, I would want to cut out of this movie. It's already 80 minutes. It's a very trim 80 minutes. But they spend a lot of time just kind of making small talk. And part of the suspense of the movie is you, like, okay, when you know, like, it's boiling underneath the surface.
Yes.
And, well, obviously, I mean, you kind of warned about spoilers at the beginning. We've established you loved it. We're going to go in full-on spoiler mode right now.
Yes,
and
we
just
are.
Kind of break down the movie. Let's do it. I love the idea of Jesse writing a book, like, about their experience.
Yeah.
It's very similar. It mirrors what Linklater did, which is to write the movie and make the movie about his experience that he had with this woman that he met in a chance encounter. And he was in a very similar predicament where he was kind of always hoping the woman would show up and that she'd come to a premiere of one of the movies and he'd be like, hey, remember, this is great. We find Jesse kind of at that point where, and we don't know it from the get-go, but he is he's experiencing kind of like a spiritual, emotional crisis in his life, like a not quite a midlife crisis, but like he's suffering, and he doesn't really let on until later on. But I love the way they kind of talk around each other, and they're not being forthright with each other. They're not being forthcoming.
Yeah. I mean, to speak to the dialogue, what's beautiful about it is you're right. They do these things where the conversation keeps flowing toward the conversation we want them to have. And then they pull back, and there's a very natural flow to it that I think is especially gorgeous, because once again, just like Before Sunrise, there was a script, but it feels so natural. This conversation between the two of them doesn't feel like a film script. And I think that
specific aspect of it adds to that and adds to, you know, the free-flowing nature of it, because two people who haven't seen each other for a while, who have all those old buried feelings, they're not going to go right into the conversation that they have at the end of this film. They're going to feel each other out. They're going to, you know, probe the defenses, find what's going on. What are you saying? Wait, did that?
Yeah,
you know?
even somebody you have a profound connection with, and especially, I mean, obviously there's a huge amount of time that's happened between their two encounters. But it's clear that the encounter they had in Vienna was so profound for both of them that they never fully recovered from it.
Yeah.
And but no matter how close you are with someone, if you haven't seen them for a couple of years, there's always that kind of awkwardness before you kind of chip away at the ice.
Yep.
And break down into having very honest conversations. And I love that Before Sunset does that. I know a couple people were kind of, when they first saw it, were kind of like, oh, just get to the point. Why aren't they talking about it? But I was like, no. This is how it works. This is how social interactions work with people. No matter how close you are, you're not going to go, all right, we're in love with each other. You know, they play it very carefully and very delicately, because they also have to deal with a subject that doesn't really come up until about halfway through the movie, which is that Jesse is married and has a kid. And then that raises a whole other series of questions and brings a whole other flavor into it.
Well, and something I noticed too, because it really does build, and I think they hit the specific point where they address the marriage just perfectly. It's just at the right time. But through that, and I don't know whether this was conscious on Ethan Hawke's part or not, but he had his wedding ring on the whole time. But what I noticed was, I guess after I noticed it or whatever, is he would keep dropping that hand, and he would, like, his hand would come up into frame, but then he'd fidget and, like,
yeah,
sort of mask
the ring.
Yeah,
he'd play with his ring a lot.
Yeah. And so there was very much that sense. It led right into it. There was all of this body language subtext where you could tell, like, his instinct was he wanted to pull that ring off, but he couldn't because he knew it had been seen. And so there's that whole other thing that builds right into what he talks about later in the film about how he's feeling about life. And what's so fascinating about it is the fact that they're both people who have dealt with the disappointment of not seeing each other again when they plan to in their own ways. And his method of dealing with it was to get on with his life and, you know, get married, have a kid, have a career, be successful. And her way of dealing with it was to go and get in a relationship with somebody that wasn't there very often and run around the world doing things and not worrying about herself. So they're both doing these things that pulled them as far away as possible from those feelings, which I think is just gorgeous.
Yeah, I love when they discuss it, she kind of brings up the fact that she's like, you know, when you're young, you think this happens often, but it doesn't. And you take that for granted. And I think what's amazing about this movie is basically the moment where love basically has to save them both. And they both know it. And it's the moment where they fully believe that's still possible. Even though they're both, it's great because, like I said, Before Sunrise is so optimistic and so magical that I love showing Before Sunset to people because it's real life. You bring real life into it.
Yeah,
not that Before Sunrise feels not true or honest or anything like that. It's just that it does feel very contained. And I remember telling the story about Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, before the third one had come out, to a friend of mine. And she was like, I can't buy into that because I can't imagine a film. Films always show like how wonderful it is to like fall in love, but they don't show the flip side of that. And I was like, well, you should see Before Sunset because it kind of addresses it head on. And how, you know, like you said, Jesse is... he's kind of in a spiritual crisis. In the first one, he talks about how he would rather be, they have a very, very moving moment together where he tells her, he's like, I would rather know that I was really good at something rather than be a responsible, like a husband or a father. He's like, I'm not afraid of commitment, but I just don't see, that's not what drives me. I don't see that for me. And now he is that person. And now he finds himself trapped because he thought when they found out that she wasn't there, when the audience finds out, and it's a great moment because he tries to blow it off. It's like, yeah, I wasn't there either.
Yeah.
And then she finds out he was. And then he tells her, he's like, I realized, you know, romantic love was just it wasn't real. And it wasn't, I put that idea to bed and I decided I had to, maybe it was, you know, I had to be responsible and make that commitment. And it's about choosing to make that commitment. But he's now suffering the repercussions of that, where he chose I love the line where he says, I can't remember exactly what it is, but he's like, he's basically, I chose my responsible self, even if it was overriding my honest self.
Yeah.
And it's a really,
no, his perfect,
I love
his
that
perfect
so much.
Self. He said it's his yes. perfect self. Yeah. He believed that marriage and family was going to make him his perfect self, but
yes.
that wasn't who he really was.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And I, you know, the thing that I couldn't help but wondering as I keep thinking about it, is sort of a something underneath it for me, is these conversations are so honest, and you know, you write what you know, you write what comes from the heart, and all I can wonder is he was married to Uma Thurman at this point, right?
He you was, yeah. They just gotten divorced, so yeah. Some interesting parallels there.
Yeah, it definitely informed, I think, a lot of what he was talking about, why it was so difficult. And the thing that fascinates me about it, in terms of, you know, we're talking about, you know, rightly so, the writing and the flow and everything, is once again, the performances are so perfect that I forget that I'm watching actors. And Linklater, the camera movement and the shot composition really feels like you're just sitting there, you know, you happen to be a bystander. Mm-hmm. And you're just observing this going on. And I think that is, and we had, I think we had talked about this, that I've seen Boyhood, but you know, so that would that skew things? And I think it does, in the sense that I think that you see with Before Sunset, his movement toward perfecting that sort of observational filmmaking.
Yeah.
It's there in Before Sunrise, but it's still very, like,
it's not conventional narrative, but it does have conventional, there are transitions, there are montages. Before Sunset doesn't,
right.
It doesn't use any cinematic tricks.
Right.
It's 80 minutes of this is happening right now.
Right.
You are living this with them. So it's more difficult in a way, because you can't trick the audience with those transitions. You can't add a little musical cue to kind of add an upbeat moment. It fully relies on you investing in Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as these characters.
And what's amazing to me about Linklater as a filmmaker, in light of this and Boyhood, is the fact that he, in a sense, puts the lie to all of the stuff that we consider necessary for a film to be constructed. Oh, it needs to have the Hans Zimmer soundtrack, and it needs to have the montage showing them do this, and it needs to have, and he basically has, in a beautiful way, it's almost like those rock bands that come in and they strip it. It's almost like a punk rock sort of thing, where you had all of this big, you know, 1970s, you had Meat Loaf, and you had the big Led Zeppelin stuff, and you had all the heavy metal with the grinding guitars, and then punk rock came in and it was like, we can do 3-minute songs and they're going to be awesome. And like, that's the same feeling, where it's like, this doesn't have anything that I'm used to, and it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no conventional narrative, no special effects, no romance, you know, no overt romance. Not once do they kiss each other in this movie. And it's one of the most romantic films I've ever seen.
It was killing me, because I was sitting there. No, but the thing is, you know, as a married guy, I'm like, don't do it, dude. No, no, no.
I know.
I see where you're going right now.
It's such a strange thing to watch that movie and root for him, as much as you're like, but the thing is, Not to justify it or to say, hey, everybody, cheat on your spouse. But you fully understand where he's coming from. And his suffering comes from a lack of joy and passion in his love life, and the feeling of wasting her life as well as wasting his life. And that fear of, like, I don't want us to be in a situation where we both feel like we wasted our lives,
right.
And you know, we end up getting divorced. He's like, we're already unhappy, and I don't want to take her life away from her. I want her to have a great life. I want to have a great life. I want to be there for my son. You know, it's a really beautiful thing, because it's not just there's a way I think this movie could have been like, you know, he's looking elsewhere, like he's being really sleazy about it, but it doesn't feel sleazy. It feels like he needs this because, as he keeps telling her, he's like, it felt like something was off, like our wires got mismatched, like we should have seen each other 6 months after we met. That was the way my life was supposed to go.
Yeah.
So he sees this as not like cheating on a spouse or like ruining her life. He sees this as his kind of salvation in a way. Like I need this because this is what's missing.
Well, which is still, you know, still uncool in a certain sense. But at the same time, like what they're really talking about is that, he, you know, to your point, he isn't running around trying to find it in every face and in all of these different European cities. The only person, and you can see his nerves when he first gets together with her, is that sense of, is this the one person? You know, like that their meeting is so tense at the beginning, and you get that energy of, you can tell with him, is this really, am I making a presumption here? Is this, am I right? Is this?
I mean, he devoted that whole 3-4 years to writing this book. He, you know, this is the book that now he's a bestseller. He's an author. So he's clearly, it's been in his mind.
Well, and he also talks about the fact, because somebody asks how, you know, about his next book, and it's actually a beautiful thing where he talks about, oh, I'd write about a guy who sees his daughter dancing on the table, and it's the same song as when he saw this woman he was in love with in the past, and how time is all together, where there is no past or future.
The moments are happening simultaneously.
Right. And so you can tell that that is something that he is wondering about.
It's a very Linklater idea.
Right? Yeah. Yes, yeah, very, very much so. But what's amazing, and I think you had, you know, you had said this to prepare me, I guess, in a way. But with this film in specific, when you compare, like Before Sunrise has interesting characters that you meet along the way. There are characters on the side of the road, and you know, the people with the play, the, you know, come see our play and everything. And in this, it really has none of that.
Yeah.
It is not that. It is only them.
It's all about them. And I love, I mean, it's a technical accomplishment and something to tote around and be like, hey, this movie takes place in 80 minutes of real time. But it serves the story because time is of the essence in this movie.
Yeah.
He has to catch a plane in an hour and a half. And that hour and a half has to be so focused on, like, is this the one? Can we, is, was this real? Does it mean something? So they're so focused on each other. I love, right when they leave the bookshop, there's a guy playing an accordion right outside. Mm-hmm. And it's a moment where if this was the first movie, they probably would have stopped and watched him play.
Yes.
But they're like, boom, we got to go. We got to go. We got to make stuff happen. And they are constantly focused on each other. There's never a moment where, the closest we get to that is when he's like, hey, let's get on the boat, and like an attempt to be like spontaneous and kind of recreate the magic of their first hangout. Let's go get on this boat, it'll be fun. I also love that Jesse, in the first movie, he's a little bit more cynical, like the gypsy woman comes and reads their fortunes, and he's kind of like, oh, you don't believe that, do you? And then the guy who writes the poem, he's kind of like, oh, you know, he probably just plugs that word in. And Celine's a little bit more like, oh, I don't know, maybe. She's a little bit more willing to believe that. In this movie, it's flipped. Jesse is the dreamer. He wants to believe in magic, and Celine has become very cynical and disbelieving. Like when they're talking, he asks her about reincarnation in this movie, which is a question he asked her in the first movie. And in this movie, she's immediately like, no. And in the first one, she's like, yeah, I think so. It's just very interesting how the roles have flipped. He wants to believe in magic again because his relationship has soured and become stale. She doesn't know what to believe in because she hasn't had a steady relationship, and she feels adrift after him. She feels like the magic, it's ridiculous. She tells him in the car, she's like, ugh, what does it mean even to have the love of your life? That's such an evil concept. So I love that their characters have flipped in a way. And the whole time he's kind of pressing her to be like, what, you know, he's so fascinated. He just wants to hear her talk. Like, it's just amazing to watch him kind of play that.
Well, in a sense, and I know this will sound probably a little bit insane, but I think that spiritually there's almost a part of me, again, getting back to the, you know, the double feature idea, is to me, this feels in a spiritual sense almost like a sequel to Casablanca, because Rick forces that decision at the end. Maybe not now, maybe not tomorrow, but you're going to regret not getting on that plane. Get on that plane, and you're left at the end of Casablanca. Spoilers, you've had, what, 70 years to see it?
Okay. Something like yeah. that.
Get moving. But he, you know, and he sends her off, and he's like, you know, you got to live your life. And so you're left at the end of that. Oh, wow. Would there ever be a situation where they would get back together? Would the feelings linger? And the whole reason I say that is I think that, and this might be controversial, but I think that everybody, especially after a certain age, has that one person, no matter how happy they are, no matter what's going on in their life, there's that one person where, just like Celine or just like Jesse, they're afraid of meeting them again. What if I do cross their path again? Because that was a very potent time. What would it be? How would it feel?
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you would go off and wander Paris with them and, you know, and go back to their, you know, it means that everybody, I think, if you really think about it, there's that one person in your past where you can't help but wonder. And I think that this, you know, the whole film addresses that too in a way that films, a lot of other films have tried to address, but this does it so eloquently of, I believe that my life changed because of one thing.
Yeah.
And that one thing altered the course of history for everything. And it's really easy for people to say, no, that's not, because Celine says that. She goes, no, that's not how life works. It's all of that stuff. But I'm with Jesse in this. It's like one different decision. One different choice of word, one different parting of ways, and your whole life would be radically different from what it is. And you can't help but wonder sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. And this whole movie is about that. Like, it's like the chance meeting that changed their lives. And they're kind of like, you know, did you ever think we'd meet again? No, I thought it was, the chances were slim to none. But here they are. And both of them are struggling throughout the movie to recognize that. It's like, you know, they both, I think if it was different circumstances, it would be an entirely different kind of movie, an entirely different conversation if they were both single, you know. But the whole movie is them struggling to recognize just how important they are to each other, and then finally giving way and admitting it, which is, it's amazing the way the movie goes from, you know, 30 minutes. I love that they're having very political conversations, talking about politics, and she's talking about all the stuff she's doing. You know, in the first movie, they're talking about, like, you know, he's talking about reincarnation, and, you know, are these a fraction of the souls that were reincarnated? If we all are reincarnated, da da da, and, you know, all these magical things, and talking about death and life and things that I think really end up. I think when you're younger and you're like in your late teens and 20s, you think about the things that really matter more. And then as you get in your 30s and 40s, you start to get bogged down in, like, politics and, you know, all this very adult conversation. Yeah. So I love that they spend a good chunk of time talking about that stuff. And it's like, it's just ideas. It's like, you know, she talks about how, I love the conversation about, she's like, the people who can make the biggest difference are the people who just don't have, like, the ego to do it.
Right.
And, you know, like, the little things are what really matter. Like, these people who want to get pencils to these kids in third world countries, you know, so they can write it, like, things like that. I love that they spend time talking about that, because it helps them kind of re-fall in love with each other. They kind of realize they've changed, but not so much.
Well, I think that there's also, a subtext of, yeah, they do have political conversations, but they have political conversations in the way that I was always used to having them, which is, you know, we're not going to say straight out, you know, oh, I hate this and I hate that. It's going to be, what about that? Oh, what about that? I hadn't really considered that. You know, like, it's still a respectful conversation. And I think that, I mean, the thing is, that, you know, it's by this point, it's just become boring to beat up on social media for it. But it's not social media's fault. It's the fact that everybody's in each other's face 24/7 is the fault of it. You're seeing what used to happen with people, which was you talk about it, and, you know, maybe you'd hit something where you don't really agree, and you're just kind of, let's not talk about that anymore. Let's move on and talk about the stuff that really matters to us. And I think that also, and I don't want to lose this thought, is I've heaped a lot of praise on Ethan Hawke for Before Sunrise, justly so. And I would heap a lot of praise on him for this as well. But I think Before Sunset is especially beautiful because it made me realize all over again how incredibly special and important Julie Delpy is as an actress. Mm-hmm. She is absolutely amazing because she completely sells me so much on Celine that, like, this is the type of performance where I don't ever want to meet her in person. I don't ever want to find out that, like, she raises fighting rabbits or something, like, you know, it's like, you know, hey, it's cool.
You know, she does. Yeah. Those crazy French people.
But it, in all seriousness, it is amazing to me. And I think that also a lot of the choices in camera work give more weight to Celine's character than she got in Before Sunrise. Before Sunrise was very much from Jesse's point of view in a lot of ways. And that's fair. That's enough because that's Linklater being autobiographical about it. But you can definitely tell that this is a much more collaborative sort of thing where both of these actors slash writers were able to say, no, we're telling these characters' story. This is not you fictionalizing something from your life. This is where do these people exist and where do they live?
Yeah, it was less about the experience Linklater had, and now they were like, let's just continue the story of these characters. I remember they did the first, this is in an interview, I think Ethan Hawke was talking about it, and he was talking about how they did the first shot of the film, and, you know, Linklater yelled cut, and he's just beaming, and it's like to the point where he's practically like having a fit, like a giggle fit, and Ethan Hawke walks over and he's like, dude, what's up? And he goes, I'm just so happy to see them again.
That's awesome.
And it's such, I love that. I love that these, somewhere out there, these characters are living their lives. I love that right now. They don't talk about the sequels until at least 5 years have gone by from the previous movie. So they've been playing very coy about whether or not they're going to do another one. But it's fascinating to think that they're out there somewhere living their lives and that in a few years we might get to beam back in on them and see what's happening.
Yeah, which would be, I mean, this is sort of a, this is again to speak to the Boyhood thing. This is like Boyhood in three parts, not the experience of Boyhood, but it's the similar sort of storytelling thing where I could actually see, like, Boyhood in a sense, looking at it through this lens, Boyhood in a sense is like taking these, because I haven't seen Before Midnight yet, but like is like taking Before Sunrise and Before Sunset and putting them together into one film.
Yeah.
And it makes me actually appreciate Boyhood all the more. And it's one of those things where I keep going back to, and I know I said this before, but I keep going back to, what is it about Dazed and Confused that annoyed me so badly? Like, I have to go back and rewatch it. And just,
you should.
Was I just,
you should.
Was I just, you know, and I'm sorry for the bleep I'm going to give you. Was I just being an asshole that day? Like, what was going on with me?
No, you know, Dazed and Confused, I think, is one of his weaker efforts. I just believe that. Honestly, what you should watch is, you know, go back and watch Dazed and Confused, but Everybody Wants Some is like, you know, they hailed it as the spiritual successor to Dazed and Confused, but it's so much better because Linklater, that was like his third movie. I think his second feature, I believe. And I get the sense that he's still finding his way a little bit as a filmmaker. Everybody Wants Some feels like the same Linklater that made the Before trilogy in Boyhood. He understands how to master that. But no, I'm still with you on Dazed and Confused. Loving Linklater, I go back to it and still I'm kind of like, I appreciate it more, I think, in retrospect. But yeah.
I have a you know, naturally nerdy question, but was Before Sunrise shot on film, was this, and was Before Sunset shot digitally? Or were they both on film?
I think they were both shot on film. This was 2004, so I don't think
it hadn't really matured to that point. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Lucas was out there with it, but not everybody. People hadn't been sold on digital.
Yeah.
By that point.
I think this was still in that transition period where it was like digital was still not quite there yet. I'm pretty sure Before Midnight is on digital, though.
Okay.
It looks different. It looks a little more contemporary.
See, what
Before Sunrise and Sunset.
What's so interesting to me, though, is that it's the same director, it's the same actors, it's, you know, and the writing is consistent and all of those things. And it's so interesting to me how visually I got a different sense from Before Sunset than I did from Before Sunrise. Not that I thought it was a different director, but there is definitely a conscious decision for – the framing, the, you know, the different allocation of two shots versus single shots and those sorts of things, that was really fascinating to me and really supported everything about it. And actually made, even though I had the same feeling editorially of every time they hit one of those like sort of breathing points, like say when they were walking up the stairs or when they were getting on the boat, where it was a natural end point for the film. And I think that that's why the ending works so well and grabs you so well and gets you so flustered in my case, because you go through this film where there are constant valid endings for the film, and then it chooses one seemingly at random in the midst of something. And you're like, you know, it's you know what I'm saying? Like it's you're so, I think what it does is it hits you with those natural endings so many times that it, you keep expecting as an audience member to anticipate the ending of a film. And I think that those fake outs help you at the end so that it catches you by surprise.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the thing is you're waiting for the movie to pay off as far as, but you don't know. I think what's funny is you know secretly how you want it to pay off, which is how any romance would pay off. They end up in each other's arms and they dramatically kiss and I love you, I've always loved you. So I think we're trained to expect that, and Before Sunset cuts off before that payoff. And you realize then what you thought was the payoff wasn't the payoff. It was the lack of payoff that was the payoff.
Right.
And it's kind of fantastic. I love that.
The real payoff is simply the fact that they both admit that they have been in love with each other and missed each other all of this time and can't stop thinking about each other.
Yeah.
That's your payoff.
I think there are two big points in this movie, or two big turning points in the movie, because you have one is the whole, you know, they're on the boat together, and I think that's where they really start to open up a little bit about, like, you know, Jesse's like, oh, why weren't you there? And then he starts to open up about his marriage and kind of like, you know, I feel like I'm running a daycare with someone I used to date. And he starts to open up a little bit about that. It starts to become a little bit more frank. And she's kind of like, oh, I'm sorry your love life isn't so great. And then the car ride. And it is by far my favorite, maybe my favorite scene in all three movies, which is hard to say. But it is such a brutally honest moment for both of them. They finally drop the facade. And she, I love, she calls him out. She's like, what do you, like, you come here and you're all romantic and you're married and you wrote that stupid book and it reminded me of what I used to be and how I can't be that anymore. I love that so much.
Yeah.
'Cause it's like, before Sunrise, you could watch that movie and be like, oh, I hope I could meet a Celine someday and base your whole life on the, on that idea. Oh, if I could meet my Jesse, if only I could meet my Celine. And, you know, it, but the reality is, like, that's not going to happen. It could happen, but it's, the reality is also that that person might not be who you think you are or who you think they are, and how waiting for that person can kind of destroy you in a way. And then they both kind of collapse and they emotion, like the whole time. I love, you know, the beginning, just whenever Jesse, you know, when I rewatch it and she's like, so what are your problems right now? And he's like, right now, I don't have any. And the way he kind of says it so cocky.
Yeah.
And then he finally like is like, my life is 24/7 bad. You know, I feel no joy. I've tried everything I can think of. I'm so like, I feel miserable and I miss you. And I have dreams about you that literally make me wake up in tears and I don't know what to do. I love that. And then she, in a mirror image of him when they're on the trolley together in the first movie and he moves, like goes to move her hair, he like reaches out to her face. She mirrors that image, reaching out to him, and she can't do it. I love that so much. And that car scene devastates me every time I watch it, because it's just like, whew, the whole movie, you were kind of waiting. You're like, why aren't you guys, when are you guys going to talk about it? And then boom, they talk about it, but they go beyond just simple like, oh, I love you, oh, this is great. It's you destroyed me and here's how I'm picking up the pieces.
You know, I wasn't thinking about it, but I'm glad you mentioned the trolley is the car does mirror the trolley scene in that sense, because it forces them to interact. It forces the conversation because they can't walk away.
They've spent a lot of time the entire movie. They're moving, like they stop, like, you know, they sit down on the bench for a little bit and things get a little more personal And then they kind of turn it into like a little bit more lighthearted. Oh, it's amazing what perverts we've become. We talk about sex all the time.
Yeah.
And then, but yeah, they're trapped with each other. They're constantly like going somewhere. They're constantly, they're on a boat and they're moving, but they have to stand still. Then in this, in the car, they're moving, but they are trapped with each other. They're sitting. They can no longer kind of like, oh, look at this, look at that. They have to kind of have it out in a way.
And I realized how much emotionally this film had me in that car scene, because Celine goes to get out and starts saying, stop the car, stop the car, I'm going to get out here. And he's so desperate to keep her there, to keep everything going. And, you know, something we've talked about is like it's this race against time. He's got to go catch his flight. But the sense I got through the entire film, and I think this is true, and I think this is what makes it work so well, is it's always obvious that he's using the I've got an hour and a half to catch a plane. That's his false deadline. If this goes as badly as it could go, at the end of the cafe, he can say,
out.
Yeah, I got to catch a plane. Or if she, you know, she's uncomfortable, you can catch a plane. But they both keep punting. They both keep kicking the can down the road, and he keeps, you know, oh, no, I, you know, please, I'm going
to
sit there for
it's
an
almost
hour.
Like they're using it to test each other. Like, oh, but you're going to miss your plane. No, it's fine. And then he's like, you know, she kind of brings it up almost like it's almost like she's trying to resist. Like she's trying to be responsible. Oh, the plane. And he, again, she's trying to be very cynical and responsible, and he being a little bit more, what's the word I'm thinking of? Whimsical. He is a little bit more like, no, it's fine. Let's enjoy. This is the moment. This is a moment that's been missing from his life. And he wants to know, like, is this it? Is this what I want? Is this what I needed? Is this what was missing?
Well, he just wants a connection.
Yeah.
Like, even if they don't, even if nothing comes of this romantically, he is obviously just excited to actually have a conversation with somebody and connect again.
And specifically this person who, He's never connected with anyone so strongly. This is the person that he needs. He knows his life needs right now. I need to connect with that person who meant so much to me, who got on my level, and we understood each other in a whole way I've never experienced. He needs that in his life because he is struggling.
Well, there's also something that I think is a beautiful subtext to it, of how it puts the lie to the fact that we get hung up on these artificial schedules that we construct for ourselves, where, oh, I got to catch a plane. Oh, I got to go do this. How much would it kill us? There's going to be another flight.
Yeah.
There's going to be, why would it kill you to say, you know what? I'm having a really, I'll put it off till tomorrow. I'll catch a later flight. It's not like there's one flight a day. Well, okay. Yeah. Maybe there is from Paris to New York. Fine. You got me on that one. But, you know, I'm talking about, like, how many times do we find ourselves with those artificial deadlines, especially as we get older? And what would it kill us to say, no, you know what? I can stay out a little bit later. Oh, no, you know what? I can do this. And I think that is another, you know, just beautiful message of the film, that, you know, sort of a symptom of the life that he feels trapped in is all of these schedules, is all of these obligations. And it's something that he's fighting against in his life. So it makes sense that he's fighting against it throughout this film. I don't want to be told I have to be somewhere. I don't want to feel, I want the happiness that goes with having the son or having the stable family life. But I also want the freedom, if something special and unique and wonderful is happening, to say, hey, I'm going to keep this going. And this moment is going to happen. Yeah. Like, you know, not necessarily romantically, but like anything, you know, you're out at a concert and you run across somebody or something like that. Like, there is a real, there's just so many beautiful subtexts to this film. And you wouldn't think, I mean, I think this goes also to the way that we're trained with films. And again, I'll talk about Dunkirk, because when the running time, hour and 47 minutes came out, it was an hour and 47 minutes. And with this, 80 minutes, wow. But it gives it this urgency to everything, where, I guess I'm sort of stumbling for words at this point, where it's just, it's this energy to it. But, you also realize how the running time itself is an arbitrary number. What does it matter? Keep kicking the can. And so that's why I think the ending is even more powerful, because I've told my story and it's 80 minutes long, and you're left saying, no, just like him, no, 15 more minutes, 15 more minutes. You can keep going, you know?
But you don't need it anymore. And God, I love that ending. The scene, so the car scene, that's a major breakthrough for them. And then my other favorite moment, the other big climax, the other big climactic emotional breakthrough is when she sings him the song. And it's like because the car, she doesn't so much say anything like, oh, yes, I love you. But she is kind of like, you know, I didn't forget about you and I kind of hate myself for it. And that's more of his admission. It's clear that there's something there. But I think when she brings him up and she decides to sing him the song very schemingly is like, oh, and there's also the waltz. That's no big deal.
Yeah.
So, of course, he's like, yeah, yeah, play the waltz.
Yeah.
But that's the other moment. They can't quite say how they feel, but she sings that song and that's it. That's all you need to know. And you can see it in his face that he, and again, at the end, the last line of the movie, his last line is, I know. And you can see that he knows when she's singing it. Like, he's like, this was it. This is it. This is what I needed.
And even another echo to Before Sunrise is, because you mentioned, you know, with the poet, oh, I bet he just drops that, you know, the name in there whenever.
Yeah.
He says that to her when she sings the song. And he says, oh, you just put any guy's name in there that comes up here, don't you?
Right. Which is also, I think, a response to her being like, so do you tell all the girls you dream about them, or did you say that to just hopefully get in my pants? And he's like, oh, yeah, totally. That line always works like that.
Yeah. It's so funny, too, because it does illustrate, I think, a cultural difference that exists between them and is, I think, a valid one to explore sometimes, of the type of humor from culture to culture sometimes doesn't translate, because he's constantly being that sort of, you know, sardonic cut humor. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, she's getting used to it again. She's still trying to figure out, wait, are you being serious? He's like, no, I'm kidding. But then by the end, she gets the joke. You know, they've reconnected to that point where the humor makes sense again.
Exactly. So, all right. Well, favorite scene in this movie. Can you pick one? Is there a scene that stands out to you as the scene in this movie?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. I mean, I would go probably with the same choices that you had. That car scene was heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. I wanted to cry for them. I wanted to hug them both. I wanted to tell them it was okay. And I think that was an amazing scene. And then the end, when she sings the song to him, but not just when she sings the song to him, but when she is finally sold on the idea that, no, this isn't going to end, because she doesn't say, okay, song's over, get out. She says, now you drink your tea and you get, and now she's playing along with him. We're going to incrementally increase each other's time together.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the car scene, but then, you know, the end, and also specifically how the screen goes dark. Because it goes dark in a very live theater sort of way, where it seems like there's a spotlight on her as the background goes out and then the whole stage goes dark. And I thought that was just, you know, such another statement of the beautiful artistry, the command of the camera and everything that Linklater and his crew had, the decision-making process there. Just brought it out into a reality that I wanted to believe in. And I just, I'm obviously going on and on about it again. I mean, you know, I guess I could also, just to throw a curveball, give actually a special mention then to that first conversation they have in the cafe, because I think that both Hawk and Delpy do an incredible job of conveying conveying the idea that these are two people trying to figure out if they are still the same people at their core. Yeah.
Oh, I love the moment where they do we look any different?
Yeah.
And, you know, her kind of letting her hair down
yeah.
and her pointing out the line in his head, yes. like, you know, you yeah. got a scar. And he's like, well, like a gunshot wound.
Yeah.
But I love that. It's a very vulnerable moment for them as actors. It's not like it's not like, oh, you look just as beautiful as I remember you. They're both pointing out each other's flaws. And these movies it is all about the passage of time. So they are very like honest about it and like, yeah, you do look like, do I look different? I do. He doesn't say anything. So she's like, oh, I do. Don't I? I love that. That's what these movies are all about. We look different. Like, it's like we're changing. We, you know, she talks about the dream she had. Like, I had a nightmare where I woke up and I was 32, and then I woke up in my dream and I was 26 again. But then I woke up for real and I was 32.
Yeah.
It's insane to me that I saw this movie when I was 20. I saw Before Sunset when I was 20, and now I'm their age. That's crazy to me.
It's so, you know, what's so wild to me about that, and I've thought about this a lot actually, is that there are certain movies, I think, that regardless of their rating, are in a sense maturing types of things in a dangerous way for people. And, you know, just to draw the comparison to say, I think I know what you're talking about, where Star Trek II, I saw that when I was very young. A lot of people did see it when they were very young. It's like, oh my gosh, it's so beautiful, and the Spock thing, and you know, and you know, Khan, and oh, this is wonderful. But I am finally at the stage in my life where when I watch Star Trek II, it's hitting a little close to home about life choices and how you feel about things. And it's like, oh my gosh, it's a midlife crisis movie. And so I think that you pointing that out is something where it's amazing how a film speaks to you at that younger age. But then when you're the right age for the characters or what the characters are going through, you suddenly realize how intensely amazing what the filmmakers did, and including the actors and the writers and everybody, how intensely amazing it is what they pulled off. Something that was able to speak to you and resonate at that younger age before you'd had those life experiences. And then when you see it, when you are that age and you say, this is true, this is accurate, this is how people feel and interact with each other. That's an amazing, like, that is the power of film. That is what it's all about.
It's true. And this, I hope they keep going, because this could be the definitive cinematic portrayal of love. Of love beyond romance.
So you're spoiling
it for love in general.
You're spoiling it for me that there isn't a huge asteroid strike in Before Midnight, because I haven't seen that.
Oh, you don't know what happens at the very end, but
the next one's
going to be after the apocalypse.
Oh, it switches to after.
That's it's apocalypse after.
Yeah.
It's kind of, and it becomes connected to Apocalypse Now. They're going to do a connected universe.
It all works for me. It really does. They wind up traveling through time, meeting in difference. Okay. All right. I think we've got a, you know, to borrow a favorite phrase of yours, maybe we got a stew going.
All right. Well, final questions for you. So first of all, what's our rating scale for this?
All of it. Whatever. Whatever is the top, that's what it gets. You want to give it moon pies. You want to give it bicycle chains, cars, whatever. Give it everything.
Sure. Let's give it all the points.
All the
gunshot wound scars on Ethan Hawke's forehead. That's what this movie gets.
Yes.
Here's a tougher question. Sunrise or sunset?
Don't make me choose, man. Don't make me choose. but that's the thing is, like, some days I feel like peanut butter ice cream, and some days I feel like cherry vanilla. They're both awesome. They both are fantastic. I know that there's somebody out there that's like, cherry vanilla is no good. You get the point, okay? I wouldn't take anything away from either one of them, because they're so, you know what? In all honesty, it's the Star Wars versus Empire question.
Yeah.
Which one? It depends on my mood, really. You know?
I think that is the sign of a great sequel, is when you can't think of one without the other, and you couldn't possibly pick.
Yeah.
one.
Completely.
You can
agree.
Pick one. I have picked one. You know, it's like Empire's my favorite, but
Jedi's the best.
Then I have to think. Well, then you have to think. It's like, you know, Star Wars is great too. You know, it's
Empire doesn't exist without Star Wars.
Exactly. It stands on the shoulders of that one.
Yeah.
And same with Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. Why do I prefer Before Sunset? Because not prefer. Why do I like it so much? Because I love that after they made the first one, they made one that was like, and here's what really happened.
Yeah.
And that they were bold enough to do that. That they didn't say it's going to be happy and romantic. The two lead characters never kiss each other. I know I said that before, but I feel like you don't think about that because it's it's amazing. They pulled this off as a romance when nothing overtly romantic happens in
right. It blows apart every presumption that you have about this type of film and cinema in general.
Yeah,
it deconstructs it, and I think that is something that I have really come to understand and appreciate about Linklater, thanks to you and taking me through these journeys. Is I appreciate him as a filmmaker because he does that. He truly is in a very, and I mean this in a very positive way, a postmodern filmmaker, because he's the one that looks at these are the rules and what people expect. Who says I need to do that? I don't need to. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And it works.
And it's great. And it's because he is, he's honest. I think that at the end of the day, these are films, I said this in the Before Sunrise episode, these are films that when you describe them to people, I feel kind of pretentious. Like, it's like, oh, they talk the whole movie and it's beautiful and wonderful. But there's nothing pretentious about them because it's not two people posturing themselves and trying to be like, oh, look how smart I am. Look how, like, edgy I am. It's two people bearing their souls to one another and just trying to understand each other with all the warts and the sadness and complexity that comes with that. And it's a very unpretentious kind of filmmaking to be able to just be like, there are no frills. This is 80 minutes of two people talking and they're going to walk through the city and they're just going to try to connect with each other. And I love that.
And I also want to point out one last thing is Lou Hunter, who was a legendary screenwriting teacher, either USC or UCLA, whichever one. But he, like one of his rules of screenwriting was don't have anybody be a writer and don't have people just talk to each other the whole time. And again, it's like Linklater's like, screw you, and does it.
Yeah,
and it's
pretty
awesome.
Much.
Yeah.
I'll do whatever I want.
Yeah.
So I'll end with this last question. What happens 9 years later, John, and Before Midnight?
I'm still trying to figure out what happens after the screen goes dark in this one.
Immediately after.
Yeah. Which,
ponder that for a little bit. And again,
yeah.
It's great that after Before Sunrise came out and no one wanted a sequel, Before Sunset came out, and then again, people were like, another one? Wait.
Yeah.
But Before Sunset doesn't need a sequel. And now we have Before Midnight. And
someday, nine years
from now, we'll come back and chat about
No, no. I can't. You know what? We're putting it. We don't know the specific date, but it is on the calendar. We're going to do Before Midnight.
Oh, absolutely.
And once again, to repeat what has been said before, this must be a legendary series because Sean gave them to me as a gift, and I'm watching them in less than 2 years. So there you go.
There it is. If that doesn't sell it to you, I don't know what will. And on that note, we'll close out. Feel free to follow me at Yay Sean Dorman on Twitter. I love these movies so much. I want any opportunity to talk about them. People who like these movies, it's like there's a bond there, and
yeah.
You can it's like you understand each other on a certain plane. So I love talking to people about these movies because you get to chatting and you talk about things beyond the movies about your own life. So
yeah,
find me on Twitter. John, where can people find you?
You know what? Just look for Kessel Junkie, and I will guide you to other shows that I'm on. Here on Nerd Party Network, I'm on Aggressive Negotiations, which is about the deep philosophical stuff of Star Wars. I'm on Great Shot Kid, which is about the technical nerdy stuff about Star Wars, over on Trek FM, Stage 9, which is Star Trek nerdy technical stuff and other works. And Words with Nerds. But, you know, find me. Kessel Junkie is the name that I've been known by online since 2000, whatever. So find me there.
There you go. Yeah, and be sure if you're listening to this on iTunes, wherever you can rank us, give us the happiest rating you can possibly think of.
Yes.
Just think of Ethan Hawke's gunshot wound. Just think of that. Just think of it.
Yeah.
And give a rating based on how happy that makes you, because it should make you happy.
Yeah.
But John, an extreme, immense pleasure having you on the show again to chat this movie. I look forward to when we finally get to sit down and do Before Midnight.
Me too, man. Me too.
Now, John, you better get going. You're going to miss that plane.